Okay. The 1920s and 1930s saw a tremendous pervasive atmosphere of anti-Semitism in the world, not just in Germany. The Germans had many, many willing accomplices. In fact, more than half of Lithuanian Jewry was destroyed by the Soviets and the Lithuanians. And the Romanian army, for instance, killed almost 1 million Jews. And that's true of the Hungarian army. It was and is an infection that crosses borders. There's a climate of hatred and anti-Semitism which goes unanswered. So then it only takes one madman to throw the match on the fuel. And the Germans were able to say, no, we're going to kill them all. And the other ones willingly participated in it. It was a complicated situation because of the fact that successfully the anti-Semites identified Jews with Bolshevism, communism with Bolshevism. Even though the vast majority of Jews certainly were not Bolshevists, and the vast majority of Bolsheviks were not Jews. And nevertheless, since there were Jews, at least initially, in the hierarchy of the communist system in the Soviet Union and in other countries, association of Jews with Bolshevism became fixed in the minds of many. And since the Bolshevists were ruthless murderers, fully as ruthless, if not more so, than the Nazis themselves, both had in common that they were killing for a noble cause, and that the cause therefore outweighed any human considerations, and that in fact having human considerations was a betrayal of the cause. So there was a great deal of resentment against the Bolsheviks, and that resentment played itself out against the Jews. And it played itself out in just plain murder. The debate always is, what if the Jews were not Bolsheviks? What if no Bolshevik was a Jew? Would that have made a difference? Well, it's very hard to play what if. But it is so ingrained in the Christian world that it will, anti-Semitism, that it will take a long, long time to get it out. You're talking about 1900 years of constant preaching of hatred. Generation upon generation raised in it. So it's very hard to eradicate it. And we see that in our time also, that anti-Semitism to a great extent goes unanswered. The mayor of London is currently involved in an anti-Semitic incident, right? Nobody cares, you know. Good old Red Ken, he can do whatever he wants. And through throughout the world, anti-Semitic statements, wild statements are made, and it's just the way it goes. Oh, with a Jewish correspondent from one of the English newspapers. And so the correspondent had the temerity to ask him a question. So he said, well, he said, you're a Nazi, you're a concentration camp guard. You know, all sorts of epithets. But, his anti-Semitism is well known, and it just continues. The ambassador of France made obscene anti-Semitic remarks, and he's still the ambassador. So that's a climate that exists.
The ambassador to France or of
France to England. At a dinner party that was hosted by Jews, by the way. So we cannot underestimate the importance of climate, of atmosphere, because even if there are no overt acts, nevertheless you do create, it's like a gas leak, right, that it leaks gas, right, so as long as nobody throws a match, or there is no spark, so then it leaks gas, but if it comes in contact with something that will set it on fire, you have an enormous explosion. And I think that's how we have to see the events of the 1940s in Europe. And throughout the world as well. I mentioned that in the United States there was a Catholic priest that was on the radio every Sunday afternoon, Father Coughlin, who was an open anti-Semite, and the program was devoted to accusing the Jews of all sorts of terrible things. The church did not silence him. The radio network did not take him off the air, and he only disappeared after the war was declared, and Germany declared war on the United States, and America responded in kind. So then it was no longer considered patriotic, and it began to disappear. So it's this climate that you have to understand in order to appreciate how such a thing could happen.
Anti-Semitism wasn't considered patriotic?
Anti-Semitism was not considered patriotic because Germany had made it too much of an issue. However, the isolationists in America contended that the Second World War was a Jewish war. That they brought America into the war. Just as you hear groups say that the Iraqi war is an Israeli war.
Yep.
You hear the same ideas. And all of this goes back to the great conspiracy theory that somehow we can influence these things. So Hitler Hitler wanted he had a number of goals. One goal was to eliminate the Jewish people. Openly stated goal. Second one was to destroy the British Empire and replace it with the German Empire. Third goal was to crush communism, Bolshevism, and to take over at least half of Russia, which would then become the Lebensraum, the room for expansion for Germans, who would be able to move east and And Hitler promised that everybody would have their farm, their house, their castle, and everything. And the people that were there would either be killed or enslaved or driven out, because the Germans were entitled to it all. Now, those three goals he almost achieved. He came within a very, very narrow line of achieving it, which is what's so frightening in the world. He invades Poland in September 1939. And the Polish army was a strong army, overconfident, not prepared for the type of war that Hitler unleashed upon them. Within 6 weeks, Poland was conquered. Part of the reason was that Hitler had made a secret pact with the Soviet Union, with Stalin, in which they divided up Poland, and Hitler allowed Stalin to take over Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, the Baltic states. Hitler did it because he said, next year we're going to take it back anyway. It probably was the only area of Stalin's career where he was naive, where he believed somehow that Hitler was sincere, and that the non-aggression pact would hold. Now, when the Germans came into Poland, the Germans came in from the west. A few weeks later, the Russians came in from the east, and Poland disappeared. It literally was wiped off the map of Europe. Behind the German army came a group called the Einsatzgruppen. The Einsatzgruppen were trained killers. Most of them were from the SS, but there was from the German military as well. And they had training in this due to the euthanasia program that Hitler had conducted in the 1930s in Germany, in which he killed 75,000 mental patients, killed about 30,000 gypsies. So they were trained killers. So that, to a great extent, all the human considerations were drained from them. It just didn't exist. And they spoke in terms of killing the way you talk in terms of producing an automobile, in terms of technical ability, in terms of statistics, in terms of numbers, in terms of how to do it efficiently. One of the Einsatzgruppen reported that it only expended 126,000 bullets in killing 125,000 Jews. So that was efficient. And they followed the German army. So the German army itself had terrible deprivations against the Jews. But that was like random violence. But when the Einsatzgruppen came, that was organized killing. Most of the time, it took the form of having the Jews dig large trenches. The trenches were dug in such a way that that if it rained, none of the bodies would float up. So it was like an inverted pyramid. And then they took the people out, and they forced them to undress. And then they shot each and every one of them as they fell into the pit, and then the next group, and then the next group. We have eyewitness reports from survivors. How did they survive? The bullet missed or it wasn't fatal. And at night they crawled out from the whole mass of bodies and were able to hide and somehow survive the war and came to testify. Yeah. Now, those that were killed were men, women, and children, babies. It made no difference because and these trained killers received most of the time they were drunk when they did it. And most of them at the end were alcoholics or they went out of their minds. But you're talking large numbers, right? The Einsatzgruppen were 250,000-300,000 people at the end. Some of them are still around today. They're old men. Yeah. Was part of the German efficiency is not to allow the liquor to affect them. Most of the people were killed with a bullet to the neck. The guy walked up, you know, they had like 100 people in a row at the trench, and one of the Einsatzgruppen walked up, and he had this Mauser pistol that has 50 rounds, and he killed 50 people with one shot to the neck, and then another guy came and killed the other 50, and then they waited a few minutes, and then they started with the next 100. So you didn't need much of an aim. Even so, as I mentioned, sometimes they missed. But the method of killing. It made no difference who, what, where. And so this was the initial liquidation of the Jews. Estimated that about 750,000 Jews were killed that way. And the numbers here are beyond belief, so it doesn't make any difference what the numbers are. But as we will see, this proved too expensive because you had to use a bullet and you had to use guns, and also it proved too damaging to the psyche of the people who, after a while, no matter how trained they were as murderers, began to break. And as I said, many of them became hopelessly alcoholic. Others became psychologically broken. And so the Germans now look for a much more efficient method by which they would not have to do the killing themselves. So they farmed out a lot of the killing, as I mentioned, to the Lithuanians, to the Ukrainians, to the Romanians, to the Hungarians, and to the local population. Everybody had a score to settle with the Jews. And because of the climate of anti-Semitism that existed in those countries, it was not hard to get people. And there is a certain element in society that is simply sadistic, crazy, violent. It's just there. So again, in normal times, quote unquote, so they never rise to the top, and you know, and they're somehow controlled. So you see in the wars of the drug lords and the gangs, and even here in Israel, right, you see the level of violence that's present in society. People can kill somebody because of a parking space, which in my opinion is a legitimate reason. Yes?
Hitler's plan to eventually take over America and China and conquer the world?
Yes.
After taking over England, that was his...
Yeah. Well, he felt that America would collapse by itself if he took over England, and then he'd be able to run it. Yeah. There was a large German group here in the United States that supported Hitler. German-American Bund. had support here. I remember there were marches in the major American cities with people with the Nazi flag and the swastikas and anti-Semitic speeches.
How close was Hitler to killing all the Jews?
Well, we'll discuss that. There were 11 million Jews on the European continent, including all the Jews in the Soviet Union. And he killed 6 million of them. The other 5 million, 3 million were in the Soviet Union that he didn't get to, and then because they went all the way east. And then there were Jews that hid out all over Europe, and Jews that emigrated later. And the figure of 11 million was exaggerated, because he counted in it, you know, anybody that had a Jewish great-grandfather was on the list.
So what would be real, not the, the non-exaggerated figure? Approximately.
But, well, at least it's a million overstated. Probably only about 10 million. 3 million were in the Soviet Union. The Jews in the Soviet Union in the part that Hitler did not occupy. In other words, those that were
right
east of the Volga.
So he did a pretty good job.
He sure did.
In the end, that figures about a million.
Yeah, right. So in east of the Volga, there were about 3 million Jews that were, that had many, a million had run away, and, you know, and there were Jews that lived there. Jews from the Caucasus and Afghanistan and Azerbaijan and etc. Now, Hitler felt, it's a little disjointed, but we'll try and put it in order. Hitler felt that he was going to win the war. I mean, at the end, he knew he was going to lose it, but he didn't care anymore. He said the Germans weren't worthy of winning. They weren't worthy of him. Hitler introduced, for the first time, massive bombing of cities to kill civilians, to terrorize the population. The First World War, airplanes were used, but they were basically used for throwing hand grenades out the window at the trenches, though there were raids on London in the First World War as well. But Hitler introduced this idea of massive aerial bombing in order to force the population to give in. He introduced that in Poland, where Warsaw was bombed unmercifully. Especially the entire Jewish section of Warsaw was wiped out by aerial bombing. So the tens of thousands of Jews were killed by the bombs. And he always picked Jewish holidays, because it was in September, so Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot were the days of the most intensive bombing. Germans had a very good air force, but the Russians also had a very good air force. The British woke up very late in the game. The British had practically disarmed. There was only one statesman that stood up against all of this, and his name was Winston Churchill. But he was out of favor with all the political parties and with the government. He was a lone voice in the wilderness, and it was not till 1937 that England began to rearm itself, and Britain built a fighter plane called the Spitfire, which would in essence save England. But they didn't have that many of them as they should have had. Now, after Hitler conquers Poland, he's at war with France and England, because France and England declared war. But nothing happens. It was called the phony war, because from September until the end of May, absolutely nothing happened. Now the French are behind this great defensive barrier called the Maginot Line, which makes our security fence look like a rickety little peanut fence. You can still see they take you for tours of the Maginot Line. Impregnable. Except that it didn't work. And well, whichever one you want. The in May, Hitler's first move is against Norway, because Norway controlled the exit to the North Sea. And by taking Norway, he forced Sweden, which remained neutral, but he forced Sweden to supply him with iron ore and other materials all through the entire war, so that Sweden was neutral on the side of the Nazis. The after that, he unleashes the German Air Force. It bombs the cities of Holland. The city of Rotterdam is almost destroyed. 30,000 people are killed on a Sunday afternoon. So the government of Holland surrenders without a fight. Hitler then invades Belgium. It's okay. He invades Belgium. In the First World War, Belgium fought the Germans. It fought them pretty much to a standstill. In the Second World War, Belgium has a king by the name of Leopold, who surrenders to Germany immediately and becomes a collaborator. After the war, the Belgians get rid of him. And now he attacks France. And the French army is destroyed. It is demoralized. In less than 6 weeks, France falls. So now he stands astride all of Europe. Denmark, he takes over. Denmark, by the way, was an exceptional country, at least as far as the Jews were concerned. The King of Denmark, when the Nazis ordered that all Jews have to wear a yellow star, yellow badge, the King put one on. And he went riding, the King every day rode his horse down the main street of Copenhagen, as a sign of and the Germans for whatever reason were afraid to do anything to him. So when he wore the yellow star, everybody put on a yellow star, so then the yellow star meant nothing. And the Danes organized an evacuation. Less than 100 Danish Jews were killed in the war. Over 7,600 of them were ferried across the North Sea to Sweden on one night by Danish fishing boats. That's why in Jerusalem there's a square called Kikardania, Denmark Square, and it's got one of the fishing boats in the middle of the square as a memorial. And Sweden accepted the 7,600 Jews. They were interned, but they all survived the war. So Denmark is the exception. There always is an exception which only makes the guilt of the others stronger. The same thing in the Einsatzgruppen. Those who refused to participate were never punished. In other words, German soldiers who refused to participate were never punished. But the vast, vast majority willingly participated. The fall of France brought France was divided. There was an occupied zone, which included Paris and northern France, and the French-German border. And there was what was called an unoccupied zone. The unoccupied zone was supposed to remain under French control. There was a new government in France. The great French general, Marshal Pétain, who was the hero of World War I, now became the premier in France, and he became a collaborator to the Nazis. After the war, he was tried and found guilty of treason. Because of his advanced age, he was close to 90. He died naturally. The prime minister was a man by the name of Pierre Laval, who was a French politician, but he was an anti-Semite in the 1920s and 1930s. And this government, which is called the Vichy government, because the capital was in Vichy because Paris was occupied by the Germans. Vichy is famous for its water. Vichy water, that's before Perrier yet. It's a famous bottled water in Europe. And anyway, the Vichy government rounded up and killed over 75,000 Jews. French. A lot of Jews had fled from Germany and Austria to France because they thought that they would be safe. Or they fled to Belgium, or they fled to Holland. Only those that came to England were really safe, and almost none could come to England. England did not allow any of the refugees in, except they had a series of trains. It was called the Kindertransport. The Kindertransport were children who were sent from Germany to England without their parents. And they were, but almost all of them never saw their parents again. And they were assigned to foster homes in England. Many of the foster homes were Christian homes, and they were raised as Christians. There are a number of very interesting books on the Kindertransport and the children of the Kindertransport and what happened to them. They had a reunion about 4 or 5 years ago in England. At the reunion, there were Russia yeshiva and Anglican priests. But the refugees were not accepted in England. So there was nowhere to run, really. If you ran to Switzerland, most Jews who came to Switzerland were handed back to the Germans. The Swiss are the old bad joke that God, when he created the world, stepped back and he saw that Switzerland had too much. It's too beautiful and it's neutral. So to make it even, he gave them the Swiss. So there's an element to that. The only place where Jews could run was Spain under Franco. Franco was a fascist, a dictator, to all the West, a terrible person, right? Except, you know, the ironies here are just enormous. And over 35,000 Jews found refuge in Spain. And he didn't give one of them back, even though he was requested to by the Germans numerous times. One of the anecdotes regarding that is that in 1943 the Gestapo made a formal request that he turn back, that he give them the Jews. Franco was a great dissembler, staller, you know, he never answered, like nothing ever happens with him. He never says no, but nothing ever happens. So one of his police chiefs asked him, he said, what do you, why don't you give him back? What's your problem? He said, under the Nuremberg laws, I am also probably a Jew. Because a large, large percentage of Spaniards have Jewish blood in them from the 15th and 16th centuries. So that was his answer. But there, otherwise there was no place to go, and the United States didn't let anybody in. There were refugee ships that came to the United States that were sunk off the coast of Miami, and hundreds of people drowned, and that was it. Couldn't do anything. State Department was run by a bitter, bitter anti-Semite by the name of Breckinridge, who even if visas were given, he canceled them. So anybody that got in was, was triply fortunate, because you had to climb an enormous wall of enmity and red tape. I remember as a child, one of the first words that I remember was the word affidavit. Because my mother and father were busy getting affidavits to try and bring my uncle and aunt and cousins out of Lithuania to Chicago. It never happened. I don't know how many affidavits you got. There were Jews that escaped here. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was able to come in, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Baron Kuppner was able to come in. There were Jews that were able to come in, but in terms of numbers, it's infinitesimally small. Yet, to a great extent, those Jews made a great difference in American Jewish life. Now, Hitler is the master of Europe, from the Atlantic Sea to the Russian border. His generals tell him, let's consolidate the gains. I mean, you don't win these wars without casualties. The Germans lost 150,000 men killed between Poland and the Western campaign. The Allies lost men much more. But when you win, you don't, the casualties don't deter you as much as when you lose. Now, the only country left to oppose Hitler was England, the Great Britain. and in the early 1940, when it was obvious that what the danger was, Neville Chamberlain, who had been the prime minister that had advocated appeasement, but finally came around and declared war, he retired. He resigned. He was in ill health. And the Conservative Party, in a flash of genius, chose Winston Churchill to be the head of, to be the Prime Minister. Churchill had one great weapon: his voice, his ability to speak. And he rallied England with his speeches. And he was a bulldog. I mean, he was the epitome of the British bulldog. He wasn't going to give up. Hitler felt certain that England would sue for peace. Hitler also drew up a very detailed plan to invade England. There are islands off of England, the Jersey Islands, the Isle of Wight, that were occupied by the Germans, and those Englishmen spent the entire war years under German occupation. There have been a number of documentaries on that. In fact, then there was also a movie on it. In the movie, the usual thing happens, which happens, right? Is that the German soldier falls in love with the English girl, and you have this conflict. It's something which happens. In the East, the Germans, to prevent these types of things, in the East, the Germans took girls, women, and forced them into brothels which serviced the German army. And after a period of time, they killed these women and they brought in other women so that there would never be any attachment. It would just be there. And many Jewish women were forced to undergo that as well. But in the West, they didn't do that. So in the West, you had the problem, for instance, in France, in Paris, you had many French women who took up with German officers. After the war, especially the leftists in France took revenge upon them. They shaved their heads, they branded them, they forced them to march through the streets. It was a very, very bitter time because everybody was evening the scores. It wasn't just the live and let live, because too many things had happened, too many bitter things had happened. So Hitler made these overtures to England. But Churchill refused them. He made this great speech. He said, "We will fight them on the beaches, we'll fight them on the landing fields, we'll fight them in the cities, we'll fight them in the villages. We will never surrender." One of the most famous speeches in the 20th century. I heard the speech broadcast live on radio. From BBC, the American Broadcasting Networks, broadcasted live. And he had this deep, gravelly voice, and he had a lisp, and it was so distinctive, like it was, and there was no one could turn a phrase the way he did. When he said, "We will never surrender," so then you believed that, unlike our politicians, you believed him. You believed that that's what was going to be. So when even Hitler believed him, he believed him that he was not going to surrender, and that therefore he had to defeat England. So he had planned this amphibious invasion of England. He was going to have 150,000 German troops land in the south of England and march on London. The truth is that the English were ill-prepared, because what had happened was the English army had raced across the Channel when France was
invaded because they were fighting the First World War over again. So the British Expeditionary Force lined up with the French army. And what happened is that they got trapped. So you had 350,000 British soldiers, the British army, the whole British army was trapped. And the British tried to withdraw. And they withdrew to a perimeter around a small seaport called Dunkirk on the English Channel. By a quirk of fate and of luck, the Germans had not closed that avenue. The Germans didn't realize it until later. When they tried to close it, so then the British fought them tooth and nail, barehanded, to keep it open. And 350,000 British soldiers and Frenchmen were evacuated from Dunkirk and brought to England. Every little boat in England participated. Yachts, fishing vessels, rowboats, ferries, ocean liners. The Germans are bombing all the time. But that was the miracle that they got across. And the last 15,000 British soldiers that were fighting to keep it open also came to be evacuated. Most of them were, but many were not. The German treatment of prisoners of war in the West was according to the Geneva Convention. In the East, they didn't consider them to be human beings. 3.5 million Russian prisoners of war were killed. Starved to death, worked to death, shot to death. Got nothing. And the Russians repaid it in kind. Out of the 2.5 million German prisoners of war, 30 years later, when they repatriated them, about 50,000 came back. Huh? They had an agreement between Germany and the Soviet Union in 1970, whatever, to send back the prisoners.
1970?
Yeah. So when they sent them back, they would have 50,000 that survived out of 2.5 million.
How come after so many years?
They agreed?
Yeah, I mean...
Because it was money. They needed Germany. The Soviet Union was already... After Stalin, the Soviet Union was tottering. It took a while to implode, but it was propped up by the West.
So the POWs for about 20 years?
Yeah, in Siberia. And there weren't just POWs. The Germans, the Russians made them do forced labor. Most of them died of exposure and starvation, disease. Now, the German, Hitler's assistant, the head of the Luftwaffe, of the German Air Force, was a thug, a pathological maniac by the name of Hermann Goering. Goering was obese, he wore white uniforms, he had every medal in the world made for himself. He had all sorts of fetishes. He lived in a castle. He robbed art from all over Europe and hung them in his rooms. And then he was a blowhard. And he told Hitler, listen, we don't have to invade. We'll bomb England into surrender. Same tactic that was used in Poland, and then later in the Netherlands. Unrestricted bombing of civilian targets. And this was called the Battle of Britain. It lasted for about 9 months. London was bombed every night. 42,000 Londoners died. About 180,000 were wounded. Over 2.5 million were rendered homeless. And this was called the Blitz. There was an American war correspondent by the name of Edward Murrow, who later became very famous in the United States, the head of CBS News. Edward R. Murrow. But then he was a young war correspondent, and every night he broadcast his famous words, "This is London." And you could hear the bombs in the back. And he would say, "I'm standing at this on the roof here, and this is what's going on." Every night, people lived in the underground, in the subway, because that was the major air shelter. There were a number of bombs that penetrated there. The British had the Spitfire fighters that they sent up every time, the anti-aircraft fire and the fighters. There were many Americans that volunteered to fly for the British. And after 9 months, Goering had to admit that his air force was depleted. They shot down a large portion of the German air force. But it wasn't the airplanes so much that they were missing as the pilots. It takes time to train a pilot and to make an expert pilot. And the airplanes were produced. You can mass produce, but you can't mass produce pilots. The British also lost many pilots and lost many planes. But Churchill's phrase at the end of the Battle of Britain was, "Never in the annals of history have so many owed so much to so few." When you heard him say it, you know, like. And so England stood. And part of the reason England stood is because the United States helped them. Now, America was not in the war. America had a very strong isolationist group that opposed any involvement in the war. And as I mentioned, America had a large German group as well. But Franklin Roosevelt decided in 1940 to run for a third term for president. No president had ever served more than two terms. But because of he felt, and correctly so, that America was about to enter the war, so he ran for a third term, and he was triumphant, though on a smaller scale than in his previous two elections. And he had this program that he called Lend-Lease. So America had 50 old destroyers that he leased to England for submarine duty, anti-submarine duty. And he sent them all sorts of raw materials, oil, food. And his famous statement, again, Roosevelt also had the ability to turn a phrase. He was a great speaker. His famous statement was that if my neighbor's house is burning, I don't see nothing wrong in lending him my water hose. When the fire is out, he will return it. And so that was his, and in 1940 he met Winston Churchill on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic and then near Canada. And they had what they called the Atlantic Charter, in which he proclaimed the four freedoms: freedom from war, freedom from want, freedom of religion, the freedoms that became that are the basis of Western society. And so America was an ally of England, even though officially it was not involved at all. Now, Hitler underestimated America just as the Kaiser underestimated America in the First World War.
Hitler and racial bands, the Americans were mongrels.
Well, not only Americans were mongrels, he said Roosevelt was a Jew. He said his real name is Rosenfeld. And he absolutely believed it, that Roosevelt was Jewish. And he said the democracies are weak because their system of government is too fragmented. It's not autocratic. It's not dictatorial. And therefore, they can never produce anything that's strong. And America was completely unarmed. That was true. America had an army of about 100,000 men that still had rifles from before the First World War. And the Air Force, there was an Air Force general by the name of Billy Mitchell who campaigned for increasing the American Air Force and building modern planes, for which he was summarily court-martialed. And he said America should build aircraft carriers and that air power would overwhelm sea power, all of which was proven true. But, you know, we are all wise after the fact. So America was completely unprepared, and Germany knew it, and they didn't see any problem. And they were determined now that they were going to bring England under. But Hitler said England can wait because they're not, they're not doing anything. But what England started to do was bomb Germany. That was a tremendous shock to the German people because Hitler had promised them that not one bomb would ever fall on a German city. And the bombing, England bombed Germany willy-nilly. They dropped the bombs everywhere. They destroyed civilian cities. Even at the end of the war, for the old city of Dresden was completely firebombed. Over 40,000 Germans were incinerated in it. At the end of the war, there was not a building left standing in Germany. I mean, they reaped the whirlwind. There was a British air general by the name of Harris. It's called Bomber Harris. And he was head of the British and the RAF. And he just... So even today, there's such controversy about him. There's a statue of him in London, you know, with all the heroes of all the British campaigns. There's always a petition to remove his statue, because of the fact that he encouraged and planned this type of bombing, you know, that destroyed everything. But this was a shock to the Germans, and they never were able to stop the bombing. And when America came into war, so the Americans bombed by day and the British bombed by night. It was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Non-stop bombing. The Americans claimed that theirs was strategic bombing. They bombed the factories and the arsenals of production. Though you could never knock them out. The Germans at the end of the war were producing more planes and tanks than they were at the beginning of the war.
How could that be? I've heard that.
Because they built underground factories and did it. This guy, Albert Speer, was a genius. If you read Speer's book, his memoirs, he tells you how he did it. But again, a plane without a pilot is worthless. And they used them all up. There was nobody left. We'll discuss that when we discuss now the war in the Eastern Front, but that's the way it was. Next Thursday, there is no class because I won't be here on Thursday. The Thursday afterwards is Hanukkah. What's the story in Or HaSameach Hanukkah? It exists?
Yeah. I recognize it.
So it's regular classes, though.
The afternoon they give time.
Whatever they break for 4:30, break.
Just 4:30, that's it. So it's regular, okay. 2 weeks from today we'll see you. God willing.